Thank you for that introduction, David. And from that, it sounds that what we really need is a scientist who's prepared to challenge the materialistic view of nature. Unfortunately, I'd say that today we do have one in our midst, Mr. Dennis Bledger. Dennis has flown over from Boston, especially for this conference. I'm very grateful to him for coming over. By profession, Dennis is an engineering physicist. He has worked for the research department of Harvard and for many years has been working at the Massachusetts Institute for Technology, MIT. He works in the area of defense, electromagnetic radiation, radar. Probably won't say too much about that this morning, and that's probably not a bad thing. Dennis is also the leader of the branch of the school in Boston, the Boston School of Practical Philosophy and Meditation. And he originally proposed to give a talk towards an axiomatic theory of consciousness. I'm glad to say he's got there, so his actual talk this morning will be simply an axiomatic theory of consciousness. Thank you. So, Dennis Bledger.
Good morning. It's very nice to be here, and I'd like to thank all of you for coming and for having me this morning. The reason for the change in title of my talk is not that I magically developed a theory of consciousness, but rather I had an epiphany sometime this summer when I realized that there is an axiomatic theory of consciousness to hand. I've been a student of it for several decades now, and I know that many of you also are students of it and are practitioners of it. And not to keep you in suspense, but this theory is known as Advaita Vedanta. And it was a great relief to me when I had this epiphany, because it meant that I did not then have to invent such a theory. And a great theory it is. Now, what is an axiomatic theory? An axiomatic theory is a theory that is based on axioms, and I suspect you remember that an axiom is a statement or principle that is considered to be true, but for which there is no proof. There are really two ways to come to axioms. One is through deep insight. The other is through observation or an empirical method guided by reason. And there are lots of examples in science of axioms coming from both methods. And I'm going to spend the first part of my talk giving you an appreciation for axiomatic theories coming from the great science of physics. I'm not going to give a lecture on physics. I'm only going to try to give you the most basic of appreciation for the foundations of physics, which is axiomatic. And then I will turn to Advaita Vedanta and show that there are axioms from that system of knowledge as well. What is the point? What is the real objective of my talk here? But to show that the epistemological foundations of Vedanta or Advaita Vedanta are the same as science. So we just heard from David that today we have largely a materialistic view of science. However, it's been accepted to a large degree. The foundations of Vedanta are the same when you look at the subject in this way. So despite the fact that one often hears, well, there's no evidence for these things or there are no proofs for these things, I hope to show you that actually a system of an axiomatic theory of consciousness such as Vedanta is on the same footing, same foundation as science is. So with that, let's go forward. Oh, I think we have to go back one. Right. So also by way of introduction, this is a quotation from Corona True, an interesting last name to have. She wrote an essay in 1971 entitled The Nature of Consciousness, and I came across this essay very recently, actually, after I thought I was finished with preparing this talk. And she says, consciousness is the primary fact of our human experience, and yet it is not susceptible to scientific proof. It can only be realized as personal awareness. It stands like an axiom in mathematics, the starting point of all experience. Each of us is aware that he is conscious, that he is here and awake, and yet cannot prove this awareness directly to anyone else. And so what she's saying is entirely consistent with the theme of this conference, namely that consciousness is primary. She also points out that there is no proof of consciousness, of the existence of consciousness, as we ordinarily think of proof, and that it stands like an axiom in mathematics. It is fundamental. So, now, Corona True, as far as I can tell, was a theosophist, and it's not surprising that she would hold this viewpoint. Next slide, please. I now turn to Max Planck, a great physicist who was the originator of the quantum hypothesis, really started the quantum revolution, basically simply by positing an axiom, which is that energy comes in discrete bundles or packets known as quantum. And he said, I regard consciousness as fundamental. I regard matter as derivative from consciousness. We cannot get behind consciousness. Everything that we talk about, everything that we regard as existing, postulates consciousness. This was in 1931, approximately 30 years after he formulated the quantum hypothesis. Quantum physics was well underway at this point, and so he had 30 years at this point to consider whether his feelings about consciousness were consistent with the development of quantum physics, and they were. And in 1944, he carries this forward. As a man who has devoted his whole life to the most clear-headed science, to the study of matter, I can tell you as a result of my research about atoms this much. There is no matter as such. All matter originates and exists only by virtue of a force which brings the particle of an atom to vibration and holds this most minute solar system of the atom together. We must assume behind this force the existence of a conscious and intelligent mind. This mind is the matrix of all matter. So again, we find his statements, his beliefs, resulting, as he says, from the study of matter, entirely consistent with the primacy of consciousness. Now, this view that he holds has carried forward to this day, so that in quantum physics has arisen what's called the Copenhagen interpretation. Perhaps some of you have heard of it or read about it. And this view is very much held there. A talk on the Copenhagen interpretation is a talk in its own right and involves some very subtle arguments, so I will not be able to get much further into it. I'll have a little more to say. But just to leave you with the idea at this point that quantum physics, this interpretation of it was not unique to Max Planck by any means. Next slide, please. So this is an outline that I will follow. I've given you my introduction. Now I want to look more deeply into what is an axiomatic theory by way of example from the science of physics. And I want to begin, however, by looking at criteria for scientific theories as given by Albert Einstein and Stephen Hawking, actually. Next slide, please. Right. So it's a little long, but stay with this. It's an important statement about what is a scientific theory. Again, this is from Einstein and his colleagues. It's from a very famous paper in 1935. It's known as the EPR paper. There are books written about this paper. It is one aspect of a debate between Einstein and Niels Bohr about the nature of reality in science. And so Einstein says, any serious consideration of a physical theory must take into account the distinction between the objective reality, which is independent of any theory, and the physical concepts with which the theory operates. These concepts are intended to correspond with the objective reality, and by means of these concepts, we picture this reality to ourselves. In attempting to judge the success of a physical theory, we may ask ourselves two questions. Is the theory correct? And two, is the description by the theory complete? So you can see how fundamental Einstein is, right? Is the theory correct? That obviously is the first consideration of any theory. And is the description given by the theory complete? And it is only in the case in which positive answers may be given to both of these questions that the concepts of the theory may be said to be satisfactory. The correctness of the theory is judged by the agreement between the conclusions of the theory and human experience. Note that he says human experience. And now he says, this experience, which alone enables us to make inferences about reality in physics, takes the form of experiment and measurement. Right. Good. So he makes a number of comments. I'll summarize after we look at Hawking's. Next slide, please. So this is from Stephen Hawking's. Maybe some of you have read his book, A Brief History of Time. It's an excellent book. What I like about it especially is that for a scientist, it is an intellectually honest book. He doesn't try to oversell any of the scientific aspects of what he's saying there. And he says, a theory is a good theory if it satisfies two requirements. It must accurately describe a large class of observations on the basis of a model that contains only a few arbitrary elements. And it must make definite predictions about the results of future observations. Any physical theory is always provisional in the sense that it is only a hypothesis. You can never prove it. This is a very, very important point. There are no proofs of scientific theories. They are corroborated time and time again, if they're good theories, but there is no proof of it. And so these references that I constantly hear, both in scientific circles and non-scientific circles, that this or that has been proven, is not rigorous. It is by no means a rigorous statement, and that's something that I cannot emphasize enough. And as Hawking says, no matter how many times the results of experiments agree with some theory, you can never be sure that the next time the result will not contradict the theory. On the other hand, you can disprove a theory by finding even a single observation that disagrees with the predictions of the theory. So to summarize, next please. To summarize what we just heard from Einstein and Hawking, a theory must be correct. And what that means in science is that it must agree with observation and measurement. And what we hope for is that it agrees accurately. That's a whole subject in itself as to what what that really means, but we'll leave it at that. It must agree with observation and measurement and be as accurate as possible. It must be complete, which means that it must explain everything in its domain. So a theory of the atom does not have to explain the behavior of sound, for example. It cannot be inconsistent with the theory of sound, but it doesn't have to explain it. It must be based on a few elements. So the simpler the theory, the better. And that's a very ancient idea. It must be able to make predictions so that if you do this, this will follow, this will happen. And just to reiterate, there are no proofs of scientific theories, only corroborations. So if we have a theory of consciousness, then it must satisfy these criteria, and I'll return to these towards the end of my talk. Next. So I've already defined what an axiom is, but let's look at it again. Next, please. This is the dictionary definitions of an axiom. It is considered to be a maxim widely accepted on its intrinsic merit, a statement accepted as true as the basis for argument or inference. It is synonymous with postulate, and this is the one I like, an established rule or principle or a self-evident truth. We'll see shortly. Self-evident does not necessarily mean obvious. It may take some serious insight to appreciate the truth of an axiom. And, of course, an axiomatic theory is a theory based on axioms. Right. Now, the first historical example, perhaps, of an axiomatic theory, and one that was tremendously influential historically, especially in the West, is Euclidean geometry. I suspect all of you studied the subject some time ago. This is a statement about the axioms of geometry from a Philip Frank in a paper on Einstein's philosophy of science. And he said, the axioms of geometry were the most brilliant and the most scientific example of statements which were valid a priori and therefore of an eternal validity which could never be shaken by any advance in science. And so what is pointed out here, of course, is the timeless nature of axioms. They are simply true. And they will not change as a result of any advance. They hold for all time. That certainly has been the case of the axioms of Euclidean geometry. Now, geometry is a branch of mathematics, generally considered as such, but it can also be considered as a science of space. Next slide, please. That's one too many. Go back, yeah. Uh-oh. There should be... Oh, I'm sorry. You're quite right. Sorry. Yeah, I wanted to give you an example of axioms of geometry, actually not to, again, not to try to give you any kind of a course in geometry, but there's a very important point I want to make about postulate 5, as it turns out. If you look at Euclid, you'll find things called common notions. They are also axiomatic, but they are perhaps more readily appreciated. Common notion 1 is things which are equal to the same thing are also equal to one another. That is something I think everybody can agree on without any argument. Postulate 5 is a postulate that many mathematicians over the millennia questioned whether it was actually a postulate or an axiom. And it's illustrated here in this diagram. Is there a pointer or no? What's shown here are two angles, and what is stated by this postulate is that if those angles are less than 90 degrees, then these two lines will intersect. And as I said, for two millennia, mathematicians tried to prove this. Let's go to the next slide. And what was found, of course, is that it could not be proved. And this is what Sir Thomas Heath said about Postulate 5. When we consider the countless successive attempts made through more than 20 centuries to prove the postulate, many of them by geometers of ability, we cannot but admire the genius of the man who concluded that such a hypothesis, which he found necessary to the validity of his whole system of geometry, was really indemonstrable. That's quite something. And what it points out is that for a system of knowledge based on axiomatic statements, it may well require a man of deep insight to formulate it. So although axioms are self-evident truths, it does not necessarily mean that all of us are capable of perceiving them and formulating a system based on them. All right, next slide. Now, Euclidean geometry was profoundly influential in the history of thought, and really, science that followed geometry based itself on Euclidean geometry, that is to say, on an axiomatic approach. And this is what Einstein said, 1933 at Oxford, "A complete system of theoretical physics consists of concepts and basic laws. This is really exactly analogous to Euclidean geometry, except that in the latter, the basic laws are called axioms. But if we conceive Euclidean geometry as a physical science of space, the logical parallelism of geometry and theoretical physics is complete." So, as you can see, and we'll see in the next slide, Newton based his physics formally on the exact same structure as Euclidean geometry. Let's go to the next slide. In fact, if you look at Newton's great work, the Principia, and you look at the chapter on laws of motion, it is actually titled Axioms or the Laws of Motion. Now, again, I'm not trying to give you a course in physics here, but just to give you an appreciation for the axioms of Newton's mechanics. There is law number one, which is the law of inertia, the tendency of a body at rest to remain at rest, or in straight line motion, to remain in straight line motion unless acted upon by an outside force. And law two, which is the mathematical statement of how a change in motion comes about. It comes about as a result of forces. And very simply, forces cause accelerations. So whenever you see a body in accelerated state of motion, we know that a force is being applied to that body, such as your automobile. And then law three is the law that everybody quotes, especially non-physicists, and that is, to every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. Good. Next slide, please. Newton's mechanics, laws of motion, were profoundly successful. They were able to explain motion of objects on planet Earth, in the heavens. They also were able to explain solids, liquids, and gases, and their motions and the propagation of sound in those media. Thermodynamics and electromagnetism are two other branches of classical physics. They are both also axiomatic in the same way that Newton's mechanics is. The first axiom in thermodynamics is the conservation of energy. The second one is known as entropy, which I'm sure you've all heard of. And then in electromagnetism, the conservation of charge and how charges, both static and in motion, cause the electromagnetic field and forces to arise. Next. special relativity and general relativity as developed by Einstein, also axiomatic, and in special relativity, the constancy of the velocity of light, he raised in his original paper to the level of an axiom. This was something that disturbed physicists for several years. No matter how they measured light, they found that it had the same speed, independent of the motion of the source of the light or the receiver. This was quite contrary to what was expected from Newton's physics. And Einstein, in his paper, simply starts by saying, well, that's how it is. It's an axiom. And then he invokes something from Galileo called the principle of relativity, and then simply through the application of mathematics derives all of special relativity. It's quite stunning. General relativity, he did much the same thing. He realized intuitively the equivalence of accelerating frames of reference to gravitational fields. A stunning, stunning insight. Just to bring this home, if you're in an elevator and it is accelerating upwards, you feel as if you're heavier. You may have noticed that. You feel as if you're pulled down to the floor of the elevator. You cannot tell by any experiment in the elevator whether or not that is a result of a gravitational field or whether it is the result of the elevator being accelerated upwards. It's a stunning insight. And, of course, it leads to tremendous insights into the behavior of gravitation, and all of the science fiction that we see today usually draws from some aspects of Einstein's work on either special or general relativity. Quantum physics, I already mentioned the axiom, fundamental of axiom of quantum physics, that energy is quantized. There are others. Quantum mechanics is a highly mathematical discipline in a very abstract, it can be formulated in a very abstract form. And so I'm simply referencing some papers that discuss the axioms of quantum theory. Not for the faint at heart, I'm afraid. Now, a very interesting thing, and I mentioned this earlier about quantum physics, is that the subject of consciousness comes up. This was primarily through the Copenhagen interpretation. I'm simply going to quote from Eugene Wigner on this. And he said, when the province of physical theory was extended to encompass microscopic phenomena through the creation of quantum mechanics, the concept of consciousness came to the fore again. It was not possible to formulate the laws of quantum mechanics in a fully consistent way without reference to consciousness. Basically, what was concluded is that a conscious observer is needed for anything to happen, and that you cannot speak about anything that you do not observe. It is a stunning realization in the science of physics. We cannot talk about anything that we are not observing. Imagine if we all practiced that. Right, okay, so physics is axiomatic, as we've just seen. It is based on what we call the scientific method, which is the synthesis of observation and reason. That observation usually is applied to an experiment of some kind, but not necessarily, just observing the world at large. One can often come to an understanding of physical law. It leads to the formulation of physical laws, which are axioms. There are no proofs of these physical laws. This has led to the development over the centuries of quantum physics, which is the supreme achievement of science. Quantum physics is the most correct and complete branch of science today. It is stunning in its accuracy and the predictions that it is able to make. And it has grown and expanded to include a science of the nucleus, and of the structure of elementary particles and so forth. A lot of that you may have heard about in the media. Interpretations, as I mentioned, of quantum physics require the existence of a conscious observer for anything to happen and for there to be a physical reality. Good. How are we doing? So now we'll turn to Advaita Vedanta, looked upon as an axiomatic theory of consciousness. Good. An axiomatic approach to consciousness is entirely appropriate. If it's entirely appropriate for science and the science of physics, it is certainly appropriate for consciousness. It has the same epistemological foundation. And as I mentioned earlier, an axiomatic theory exists and has existed for some time. It is known as Advaita Vedanta. Now, when I was looking at this topic, I actually did find a paper entitled "Towards an Axiomatic Theory of Consciousness," and I found it entirely incomprehensible. That was, I'm sure, as a result of my own inadequacies. However, I do find Advaita Vedanta to be profoundly understandable, and that's the good news. So let's look at it. Next slide. Now, this is a summary statement, and it's remarkably succinct. It is said to be the summary statement of Advaita Vedanta as interpreted by Shankara, the great philosopher of Vedanta. And he said... Oh, and by the way, in this statement, the word Brahman represents universal consciousness. And so what is said here is that Brahman is real, the world is an illusion, the self is not different from the Brahman. So consciousness, in this statement, is considered to be what's real and true, what is existent, what is truly existent. The world as we see it, as we call it, is an illusion. So what we usually think of as real and substantial in Vedantic philosophy is considered to be an illusion. We'll see what that means. The self, what we are, is not different from the Brahman or from universal consciousness. So our reality is consciousness. This is the basic statement of Vedanta. Next. Right. So what did Shankara say as to why the universe is an illusion? And this is from one of his commentaries on a work called the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. He said, therefore, the whole universe is transient, impure, flimsy, resembling a flowing river or a burning lamp, flimsy like a banana stalk, and comparable to foam, illusion, a mirage, a dream, and so on, appears nevertheless to those who have identified themselves with it to be undecaying, eternal, and full of substance. So we attribute to the world the qualities of consciousness, namely that it is undecaying and eternal, and that which is transient, impure, flimsy, etc. And actually, I saw for the first time yesterday a banana stalk at Kew Gardens. Very interesting thing, that banana stalk. So this is why the world is considered to be an illusion, because of its transient nature. And if you actually consider what is something that is constantly changing, it's an interesting question. What is something that is constantly changing? How could it be anything other than an illusion? Right. Now, in Vedanta, there are these great statements, which I'm going to equate as axioms. They are known as Mahavakya, or great statements, or here, great Vedic dictums. There are said to be four of them. There are other great statements in Vedanta. We'll look at some after this. But these are the four, and they are Tattvam Asi, meaning that thou art, that is equated with the Brahman or universal consciousness. So again, it's saying that what you are in truth is consciousness. I am Atma Brahma, this self is Brahman, or this self is consciousness. Prajnanam Brahma, consciousness is Brahman. So that simply equates the Brahman to pure consciousness. And lastly, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman, or I am consciousness. So you can see these profound statements are all about the reality of ourselves and the reality of the world is pure consciousness. It is the primal element. Next slide, please. These are two other great statements. All this is Brahman. This is born from, dissolves in, and exists in that. And then all that is in front is but Brahman, the immortal. Brahman is behind. Brahman is on the right as well as on the left. Above and below, two is extended, Brahman alone. This world is nothing but Brahman, the highest. Right. So these are the axioms of Vedanta, statements that are considered to be true of an eternal nature, but for which there is no proof, again, as we think of, for example, proving a Euclidean theorem. Next slide. So just to summarize the nature of consciousness as it is expounded by the Upanishads and Shankara, it is self-existent, it is eternal, unchanging, unmoving, unmanifest, non-dual, unknowable via the senses or the mind, and of the nature of a witness only. Now, the word witness is an interesting word. It's used, obviously, in a legal sense as somebody who has actually seen something and can speak about the truth of it. But a witness is also someone who is full of wit. And someone who is full of wit, we usually consider to be full of intelligence and blissful. So witness is of the nature of consciousness, knowledge, and bliss. And finally, I have to go beyond axioms here lest I anger the sages in all that I've said so far. Advaita Vedanta is not fundamentally an intellectual tradition. It doesn't stop at pure intellectualization. It is a tradition of self-realization. So the aim is to actually realize for oneself fully and completely the truth about existence, that it is consciousness. And Shankara tells us what's needed to realize this truth. And he says that first there must be discrimination between the eternal and the transient. So one must separate that which is changing from that which is not changing. One must not be fooled by the ever-changing appearance of the world and identify oneself with it, but must remain conscious in every moment. Renunciation of the fruits of action. And then there are these six virtues of tranquility, forbearance, faith, poise, concentration, and self-control, and longing for liberation. Now, this is the predictive aspect of Vedanta looked upon as a science. Because what is being said is that if you practice these disciplines, then you will come to know the truth about existence. Next slide, please. So here I return to those earlier criteria of scientific theories. Whether Vedanta satisfies these is something everyone has to answer for themselves, but if I could be permitted to speak from personal experience, is Advaita correct? That is to say, does it agree with observation and measurement or experiment? I can't say that personally I have validated everything in Advaita at this point, but certainly everything that I have seems right, and I haven't seen any inconsistency as of yet. Is it complete? That is, does it try to explain everything in its domain? And for example, let me contrast this with what was mentioned earlier by David, that mind and consciousness arise from the brain. Well, that leads to insuperable difficulties. The materialistic view has not been able, and I believe cannot possibly explain mental phenomena. They struggle and struggle and struggle, and if you have read or hear the arguments as to how they feel mind arises from brain, they just don't satisfy reason. So in the Advaitic point of view, as we saw earlier, consciousness is self-evident or self-existent. It does not arise from anything. Now, in the arguments of the materialists, they argue that that doesn't explain anything, to say that consciousness is self-existent. However, in science, and let's take the simple example of gravitation, we accept that if I drop this on planet Earth, it will fall. Right? And yet, there is nothing I can point to that causes this to fall. We simply give it a name. We call it gravity. We study its effects, and we create a whole science of it. We say that there is something there called a force which produces obvious effects. We have no difficulty with this in science. Over the centuries, we've come to accept that this is so. There simply are natural forces, gravitation, electromagnetics, and nuclear forces. We cannot see them directly. We can only see their effects. And so similarly, consciousness, by analogy, is not unlike the forces that we admit exist in the natural sciences. Advaita is certainly based on a few elements, and as I said earlier, it is able to make predictions in the sense that if you practice the disciplines that are recommended, you will come to certain realizations. And just to reiterate, there are no proofs of scientific theories, and so anyone who argues that there is no proof that Vedanta is true, that is not a valid argument, because very simply, there are no proofs for theories. You can only corroborate them in your own experience. Next. So, in conclusion, the primacy of consciousness cannot be proven, but can be taken as axiomatic. What matters is to demonstrate that an axiomatic system, such as Advaita Vedanta, is correct, complete, and answers all the questions of life, mind, and consciousness. I'll leave it there. Thank you. If you're interested, the slides are available at my blog, djbledger.wordpress.com.
Well, Dennis, thank you very much for that rather brilliant exposition. We do have time for one or two questions now. There will be time later in the day to pursue the debate further, but just following that in immediate response, are there any questions that arise?
It seems to run parallel with the soul. Do you have any observations on that?
Well, the soul is a term that's used a lot in Western traditions. It seems to mean different things every time I come across it in different traditions. Emerson spoke of the Oversoul, which I would equate to the Brahman or universal consciousness. In other writings, the soul seems to refer to the mind or to what we call in some traditions, the causal aspect of the soul. So you really have to tell from the context what specifically they're referring to.
Thank you. I may have misunderstood you to say that something is not happening if there's no observer. Or did it mean it can't be said to be happening if there's no observer?
Yes. In quantum theory, the interpretation, at the very least at the atomic and subatomic level, is that the system that's being considered is not in any state until it is measured. And this has to do with the probabilistic nature of quantum theory, which says that a system has a probability of being in myriad numbers of states. And until you do a measurement on the system, it does not come to that, to be in that state until it is measured. So if it is not measured or not under observation, it is not in any one state of being. You can read about this at length.
Picking straight up from that last point, if what you've just said is true, it implies that before there were life forms in the universe didn't exist. Or what?
I'm sorry, but it has a probability of being in an infinite number of states.
I think that's a very slippery answer. I feel I've been wrong-footed by you, but we haven't got time for a discussion.
Well, if I could take a second, in my backup slides is a quotation from Heisenberg. So just to show you that I'm not expressing personal opinion here, could we go to the backup slides and advance them until you see Heisenberg? So this is one of the great founders of the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. And he said, it should be emphasized, however, that the probability function does not in itself represent a course of events in the course of time. There is no description of what happens to the system between the initial observation and the next measurement. This looks as if we had introduced an element of subjectivism into the theory, as if we meant to say what happens depends on our way of observing it or on the fact that we observe it. Further on, he says, some physicists would prefer to come back to the idea of an objective real world whose smallest parts exist objectively in the same sense as stones or trees exist, independently of whether we observe them. That, however, is impossible. Now, I'll have to refer you to Heisenberg's text called Physics and Philosophy, which is spectacular.
We should, leave it there. That's obviously opened the debate and have this interesting question of who is this observer or ultimate witness. But maybe we should now, I'll pass on to David Lorimer, our co-chair, to introduce our second speaker. There will be much time for further questions later on in the day, I assure you.